everyone, and welcome to another episode of Pulse. As you all know, our September episodes are focusing in on the research that's happening in Oklahoma and nationwide. We're hoping to really break down the data, break down the numbers, and the work that all of the researchers in Oklahoma are doing, and really highlight that and how important it is. So our other episodes of this series are with the Arnell Family Foundation on the declining rates of violent crime in Oklahoma County. And we also were so lucky to be able to have some researchers out of OSU that helped us break down the correlation between pollution and prison location. But for this episode, we are going to break down the fines and fees experiment that was done in Oklahoma County and break down the importance of that work and where it can lead us to, because we are lucky enough to have later this week a webinar with those researchers to continue to break it down. So we're hoping this can be a two-part and complement each other and really be able to show how you should contextualize this study in what you're seeing in everyday life, in the news, current events, and also just undermine the importance of it. So before we get into the meat of it, I'd like to introduce who I have with me here today. As always, I am joined by my co-host, Michael.
Hey, happy to be here.
And we're very lucky to have back with us again, for everyone who saw our legislative fines and fees episode a while back, we're lucky to have David Gately back with us, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself as well.
Yeah, sure. Thanks again for having me back. I'm so excited. I'm a big fan. So I'm David Gately. I am the criminal justice policy analyst at the Oklahoma Policy Institute. I'm also a lawyer here in the state of Oklahoma. So thanks again. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. We are so happy to have you here. So beginning in the early 2000s, the Oklahoma State Legislature began to cut funding for court operations, but allowed the imposition of fees to cover this lost revenue. And fines and fees has therefore become quite a concern for a lot of advocates, for a lot of criminal legal reform advocates, and for court actors as well, as they see this shrinking state budget. And due to this issue specifically, a study was done in Oklahoma County by Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia from the years of 2017 to 2019. And then their data came out, I believe, in 2021. And this study sheds light on the predatory nature of these fines and fees in Oklahoma. And though we really encourage everyone to read this study, it is extensive. And so that's another reason that we're breaking this down, is there's often with research paywalls involved, and they can be kind of inaccessible. Not everyone has the time to break down page upon page of some pretty localized or specialized words and content vocabulary as well.
I'll start there. And I kind of want to set the stage about why do we look at fines and fees, and why have they become a part of the system that is not only predatory, as you mentioned, but also incredibly damaging to individuals, to families, and also to the court system itself and everything that comes with that, including victim services, trauma care, those kind of things. And so I think it's important to realize that fines and fees are a piece of the criminal justice system that is beyond just what we think of as incarceration, so jail or prison. I also think it's important to look at the history of this. It's kind of the context of how we got here. I mean, I think the study does a really great job of laying that out at the beginning. These fines and fees are a product from a movement against taxes that came out of the politics of the 1980s and 1990s, and it sought to shift the financial responsibility of a ballooning criminal justice system to the people that are actually caught up in it, the defendants, not what they would see as your everyday, not justice involved taxpayer, but to the actual defendants who are caught up in the system. This was completely misguided for so many reasons, but it's also really damaging in the long run, as I mentioned, for individuals and their families, our courts, and our local economies. So what the system now is, it's often referred to as a fee-for-service model. And that's what this study was trying to look at, is how does these fines and fees affect the actual outcomes for individuals who have these assessed on them for being justice involved? And really, this model of fines and fees from court involvement, it creates a host of problems that the study points out, many of which are not just financial problems. And that's why I want to start with this context, because when we think of fines and fees, we're thinking about just the money that people are having to pay, but it goes so far beyond just those financial problems. For example, the study points out fines and fees lead to things like diminished voting rights. That's true in Oklahoma. It also undermines trust in the system generally. I think the most insidious part is the system of surveillance and control in low-income communities, particularly in communities of color. And this is actually reflected in our data at the Oklahoma Policy Institute, Open Justice Oklahoma, which is our wonderful data program at the Oklahoma Policy Institute. Their data also shows this is true beyond just Oklahoma County, where this study looks at, but in communities across our state. So for example, if you look at Open Justice's fines and fees dashboard, you can go look on the website and kind of see a heat map of sorts of who these fines and fees are affecting, what kind of outstanding warrants for failure to pay those are. And the highest prevalence of court debt is in zip codes that are predominantly poor and predominantly communities of color. But I also want to point out, that said, it's also true for many of our rural counties as well, where rural Oklahomans carry a larger burden for court fines and fees. I just want to point that out before we get started, but this study is looking at those effects beyond just the financial issues, but what do these fines and fees mean for outcomes later? So here they took two groups, and in one of those groups, they chose to actually pay off all of the court debt. So they had a deal with the county and they paid off all of the court debt for one group, and then they didn't for the other. I looked at the outcomes there. The recruitment was in jail and in courts. They must have been convicted because that's when the fines and fees actually take place. And they must have been assessed actual fines and fees. I want to point out too that no acquittals were included in this data. And then again, they were assigned to either a treatment or a control group based on just randomized. So a random number generator placed those in the group. So again, the control group had the court debt paid off. But they must also still comply with all of the court conditions that come with, you know, if they're on supervision, their supervision conditions, probation, parole. And then they also had to, if there was a class that they had to take or therapy or something of that nature that was mandated by the court, the classes were also paid off by the study.
That's great. Actually, you saying that reminded me that we talk all the time about fines and fees, but there is a difference, and it might not actually be as common knowledge as we might think. So fines, you both of you will probably have to correct me, but this is my understanding of fines, so we'll see if I'm correct. Fines are imposed upon conviction, and they're intended, or so they say, they're intended as deterrence and punishment, so to speak. An example would be if you got, say, a $50 fine on a low-level offense, like a traffic violation, or, you know, that number can go up. I think in Oklahoma, if I'm remembering correctly, we have an automatic, is it $2,000 fine for trafficking? I think I might mix that up, but these are meant to be part of punishment. And fees, in contrast, were intended to, so the legislator says, intended to raise revenue. And they're automatically imposed, and they don't have any relation, in my understanding, to the committed offense. So it could be, you know, like a DA fee, or there's a million of them, processing fees. These are like the court-related, court-appointed attorney fees, court clerk fees, filing fees, DNA fees, jury fees. If anything that you can think of that's criminal legal related, that could be a fee. And then another word that's thrown around, we won't be really using it here, but I think it might be nice to kind of categorize it in this conversation, is restitution is another word that's utilized in this as well as part of the punishment or so deterrence side of things. Please, anyone correct me if I was wrong.
Yeah, that's basically it. And just to distinguish between restitution and fees, is the fees are going to the state and restitution generally goes to a victim.
Right. And one thing I'd point out as well, actually, of what you were saying on the fees side, which is going to fund courts, it's like, you know, a tax, which essentially is what it is. Those go to fund court systems. I also think it's important to point out that a lot of those fees have absolutely nothing to do with the actual conviction. So say, for example, there may be a drug charge, for example, where there's no victim, but the individual will still have to pay into fees that go to victim services or trauma care fees, as I mentioned before. So really, these fees have absolutely nothing. They're not even tethered at all to the actual conviction. They're just there as a form of a sort of a dumping ground for state revenue.
And just to point out the depth of this problem, I believe in 2016, the court system was funded through general revenue at 5%, but in 2003, it was at 44%. So you can see that there's been a huge swing in how the court system is funded in Oklahoma.
Right. We did a interim study last session that also showed that 95% of the courts and district attorney's offices, their model of funding was on the backs of criminal defendants that were assessed specifically through fines and fees. And that 27%, another statistic that came out of that was this 27% of people with prior criminal justice involvement are unemployed. So it's important, you know, when we're talking about how unstable this model is. Well, a huge reason it's unstable is because of the direct population that we're talking about. There's not enough second chance employment opportunities. There's not job training inside of the facilities that these people are being held. So people who are struggling to find employment will, of course, be unable to make monthly payments on their outstanding court debt, which is also very often egregious. We have an ambassador that works for us who came out of the court system with over $180,000 in fines and fees. And she works 2 to 3 jobs consistently to keep a roof over her and her kids' heads. So to bring that full context, like David said, before we really get into this, it's just these are real people who should not be burdened with the full court system on their backs.
Right. And I would point out too on that the vast majority of these people too have court-appointed attorneys, for example. I mean, they have been deemed by the court to be indigent, too poor to pay for an attorney, and they need a court-appointed attorney. But they're then not too poor to be strapped with thousands of dollars in court debt, a lot of which are fees that then go to pay for our court systems, which, as you can see, I mean, these individuals, they don't have the means to pay this. And the court has already determined they don't have the means to pay this. And so it leaves our court systems underfunded. It leaves, again, victim services underfunded, and it leaves our law enforcement underfunded as well.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because obviously in a situation like this, we tend to focus on how it's unfair to the person who has the fines and fees assessed on, that, you know, this system is really hurting them, but it's also unfair to the entire court system because they're relying on a funding mechanism that they know they may not get. So it's not fair to almost every party involved. And that's something to think about when we're talking about this.
Right. I mean, Mike, you've also highlighted for us before the lost GDP when we, A, keep people out of the workforce, but also when we're diverting this money that individuals are making and trying to live, they have no additional income that could be used to stimulate the economy. So we, as a community, this problem really does snowball into something that is larger and impacts all of us at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. Without getting into too much of economic theory, basically, people tend to spend money locally. When they have disposable income, they tend to spend it locally. I know that was probably more true in the past. I know with Amazon and all that, things are changing slightly. But in general, people spend money at local businesses. And when they don't have that extra money, then all the local businesses suffer as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, the study addresses this as one of their hypotheses. If you look at the study, it's number 3 of their hypotheses, is that, you know, criminal legal debt, it results in an economic transfer from a pool of mostly poor people who've already been deemed indigent by the courts to a court system. So we're transferring wealth, economic growth, economic wealth, economic well-being from the people who need that money to stay in their pockets the most, and who will be most likely spending that money in their local economies. Hundreds of millions of dollars being sucked out of communities who need it most. And so that is a piece of fines and fees, is that it is a way for the most disadvantaged individuals to transfer wealth to a system that will most likely in turn then go around and harm them more. So I think that is a great point and a great discussion that we're having on that piece.
Yeah, I think that something that I found when I did read the study that was really refreshing is that they really did break it down for you in kind of a step-by-step. And it showed how all-encompassing the study was and helps you see how all-encompassing the issue is. I do think that, I know it can be super daunting for people when we talk about a study and talk about you going to read it, but I really do think when you piecemeal this one out, I personally would just like to say that I have read a lot of studies and this one felt very digestible to me.
I agree, because, you know, I think what this study does really well is, as you said, it kind of outlines where they're looking at the issue, how they're looking at the issue, and where in the issue they're trying to find the data. But also it really tethers it back to the real world. And unfortunately, particularly in the state of Oklahoma, there are so many people who are affected by court debt and fines and fees generally, whether it be for a traffic ticket or whether it be for a misdemeanor or a felony conviction. And so reading through this, I think a lot of people will see themselves or their family members in this study and see how, you know, wow, that makes sense, because I see it every day. I see it in the courts. I see it in my family or wherever it may be. They can see it reflected from the study and how it actually works in practice and in the real world. Also on the hypotheses, you know, when we're talking about the effects of fines and fees, I do want to point out their first hypothesis, that is that the relief of debt actually reduces financial and emotional strain, which then reduces the likelihood of new arrests and reincarceration. And they do this really great. They point out the data and the literature on this subject, that when people are stressed financially and they're pulled thin financially, which is what these fines and fees do, and they do it really well, it can create additional problems when it comes to new cases or being rearrested, and not just for failing to pay those, but just the stress and the strain that comes on families from paying this actually leads to more what the courts would define as criminal behavior. That kind of speaks to what this does emotionally and psychologically to families who are having to deal with this.
You came to the right place to talk about strain theory. I'll say that. Basically, what I've been really, I'm sure the listeners are tired of hearing about it, but what I've been really interested in studying recently has been the impact of poverty on instances of violence, because we can all surmise that more poverty will equal more property crimes just because, you know, as a method of survival. But study after study shows through this strain theory that David is talking about that it actually raises instances of violence as well, which wouldn't be primarily connected to economic station as easily as property crime would. But this strain that you're talking about leads to acts of violence in our communities that can be avoided if we reduce the amount of poverty. We're basically sentencing people to poverty, and poverty is creating violence.
That's so great. And I would love to talk with you more, Michael, about strain theory and about that. I think it's so timely too right now as people try to talk about what they see as rising crime, rising violent crime across the nation. I think it's important to take a step back from just solving those issues through the criminal justice system, but looking at them as more of a, we need to solve this issue in our communities before throwing people away or assessing large fines and fees.
A saying that we have come to use originally, ironically, and now Oklahomans for Criminal Justice Reform finds ourselves using it quite frequently, is you eat an elephant one bite at a time. Though that sounds crazy, I think where I take that is you've got to look at the big picture. You've got to look at the big elephant. And then you have to assess where it is that we can make effective reform. And effective reform isn't always just, you know, a sentence reduction, which some people in some cases could benefit from that. But I think it's important to know when looking at studies and research, they're also looking at the big picture. We all are looking at, okay, where can we make effective change? And for people who do want to read more, I think, Mike, you have 2 blog posts, if I remember correctly, on our website, just kind of like he said, that strain theory. And that would be at okjusticereform.org under our newsroom. And I highly recommend that people go and read that in our other blogs as well. But kind of centering us back in the study, one of the first findings that I do want to start to pivot us to is exactly what you were saying. Relatively minor crimes are burying already struggling defendants in debt. The average amount owed on prior cases for new misdemeanor charges was $1,140.69. And then when we look at the two groups, the control group participants owed an average of $2,920 at the time of their most recent misdemeanor conviction. And as we continue to characterize this, David did note that if there were classes they had to take, if there were different requirements of supervision or their conviction, supervision in and of itself is a $50 a day fee. So really think about how those charges could add up also. So yes, they have this initial, and that is usually always pretty egregious, but also it's recurring. It's constantly adding up as well, which I think also can add to that emotional strain as well. And then kind of the last tidbit of data to circle us up in this idea that people are being buried in debt is that 58% of those receiving a misdemeanor charge in the study were unemployed, and 49% received some form of public assistance, and 40% had unrelated debt that was over $1,000. So we see this high charge. We know that it's continuing to increase. And then when you look at this population, I think this last bit is really what just makes this data so impactful, is that this population specifically, these lives are already so impacted in terms of money and finances. And that's just exactly where they're being tacked again, just kicking someone while they're down.
Oh, sure. I was, reading through this study, seeing the demographics. If you look in the study, they have a table that outlines it, and many of you just went over, but there's just so many shocking data points there. Overall, within the control and the non-control group, 74% of the people in the study did not have a valid driver's license. 61% of them had a substance abuse problem. So you can see how these are targeting certain demographics who are already struggling, not just financially, but in many other ways as well. Even just as simple as having a driver's license, which then helps them to gain more economic well-being. Maybe that's to go to a job or to take your children to school or to go to school yourself. And so I think that's just so important that this demographic of individuals, beyond just the financial strain, there are so many other strains in their lives beyond just that. I wanted to point out too, in the study, when we're looking at the control group, and as you mentioned, the accumulation of additional debt beyond just that misdemeanor, that is what one of the results that the study finds is that there is significantly more control group participants that had accumulated additional debt. And then also that those went to things like private collectors, which then causes more strain as they begin to try to collect on all of that outstanding debt. It leads to income tax refunds being intercepted, which for so many families can be a time where they have more money than they usually do. And so it's a snowball effect, as you mentioned.
Yeah. And these are also, they're talking about misdemeanors, which, like, we're not talking about like armed robbery or something of that nature. We're talking about misdemeanors. And like section 905 of the Oklahoma Criminal Code makes it a misdemeanor to profane, swear. These are the types of laws that are on the books in Oklahoma that are misdemeanors. Now, whether they're enforced or not, but it just gives you a sense of the types of crimes that these people are convicted of. I also just want to point out that we've been talking a lot about the local economies, and this study did take place in Oklahoma County, but there are rural counties across the state that are way less flexible than Oklahoma County. These small businesses rely on people coming into their stores and spending money, and it's just crippling for these rural economies that are inherently less flexible.
That is such a great point because, as you mentioned, this study was done in Oklahoma County, very urban Oklahoma City core. of the states or the capital is, where a lot of our businesses and headquarters and things are. This fines and fees issue is broadly harming so many of our communities across the state, including rural that you mentioned, Michael. You know, our work at Oklahoma Policy Institute, Andrew Bell, one of our policy analysts, put out a great blog looking at this issue specifically about rural communities. And, you know, for example, Rogers County, which is a rural county, they have the highest fines and fees assessed per capita, much larger than places like Tulsa or Oklahoma County. So what does that say to rural communities, as you said, who have much less flexibility when it comes to their local economies and revenue and just small businesses? So I think that's so great that you point out. So like Rogers County, that's where like Claremore is. You know, the next highest is Adair County, which has like Stillwell and Marietta. So these are rural communities that are being assessed higher fines and fees per capita than almost anywhere else in the state.
And these are communities that we know would benefit from additional resources as well. We have been able to, especially in terms of State Question 781, we specifically know these communities not only have financial strain, but they have other strains as well. These communities need mental health resources, substance use treatment facilities, all of these things that these communities already need, that they could be getting to alleviate some of this problem. If they had the substance use treatment facilities, then we'd be diverting some individuals from even being a part of the criminal legal system. So again, this is looking at what we were talking about. You don't always have to just assess change fines and fees to be changing the system. We've already voted in favor of State Question 781. And in fact, it has become more popular since it was voted on, though it has not been implemented. But think of the actual change we could make in communities when we assess both of these issues. When the state legislator finally gives that funding to the counties so they can invest in their communities, and we reduce some of these egregious fines and fees, we will be uplifting our community members exponentially.
You know, I think State Question 781 that you mentioned is a perfect example of how the state can invest in these communities. Because think about it, if we can divert somebody from getting a misdemeanor or a felony in the first place, give them what they need beyond just a conviction, then that means there's no fine or fee that comes along with that justice involvement. And so we should be investing in ways beyond just fines and fees, as you mentioned. We should be investing in programs and services that seek to prevent justice involvement in the first place. And you know what? We know best practices. We know what that looks like. And 781 is one of those. You know, as you mentioned, the people voted for that. That was a state question that overwhelmingly passed by the people who said, you know what? We do want these investments, not in the criminal justice system. We want investments in our communities for things you mentioned, mental health, substance use, job training, even housing, employment services, helping people find jobs. Beyond just fines and fees, we need to make those investments. Last point I want to make on that too, about investing in communities. It's important to note, I don't think anyone on this call would say, let's remove fines and fees and then not replace that funding somehow. We're saying, let's replace that funding with consistent tax revenue, budget revenue from the legislature to make sure that we are not underfunding things as we begin to move away from a model that relies on fines and fees.
Yeah, that is an excellent point, because as the study points out, most of the money's not even collected. They can say that you owe all the money you want, but when the people don't have the money, it's not going to be collected and it's not going to go to the court system.
Absolutely. And you know, the study addresses this piece of just how much is actually paid. Their analysis of the control group, which is the group that didn't have the fines and fees paid, so they were still dealing with that, what was being studied here, they found that only 11% of those people were able to pay an amount that represented 10% or more of the debt that they had in their current case. Only 11% was able to pay that. And only 5% of the respondents were able to pay an amount that was equivalent to at least 1 year's worth of payments. The study points out is about $300. These fees and fines, this court debt, is not being paid in the first place because people can't pay it. It's not that they don't want to. It's not that they don't feel already forced into and obligated to pay because they have the entire court system forcing them to do this. It's because they can't. They don't have the funds to do it.
Just think about how that can add up. So say your payment for fines and fees is $43 a month, and your payment per day for supervision is $50. And then think about the rent situation that we have, especially in Oklahoma County. Oklahoma County specifically has had a huge increase in outside investors taking and really driving up the prices of rent and properties. So now you've got an additional burden of costs. We know that inflation is increasing and groceries are more expensive. When you really break down what these finances look like in a holistic picture, you can see truly how burdensome it is for these individuals to have this hanging over their head.
Right. And at the cost of non-payment is really, really high. You know, we know that people aren't able to pay because they don't have the means. Also looking at what does that mean when they don't pay? There's so many consequences that come after somebody has an inability to pay. So that can lead to failure to pay warrants, which can land someone back in jail or prison. It leads to, as I mentioned before, tax intercepts. The study points out that I think it was something like 90%, 89% of the control group participants had their tax refunds intercepted. That's money out of the pockets of these families that we know could really use it. And so there are repercussions for non-payment simply because they're too poor to pay in the first place and are assessed fines and fees that are too high for them to ever be able to meet. I think the private debt collector, 1 in 6, the study found, 1 in 6 respondents had their court fees sent to private debt collectors.
And of course, failure to pay warrants are a huge problem. I think we saw that from 2018 to 2020 in only Tulsa and Oklahoma counties, there were 40,000 failure to pay warrants that were issued.
Wow. Yeah. And the study points out that Oklahoma County doesn't actually, or they don't make arrests for failure to pay warrants, although the warrant is still issued by the court. It's still a valid warrant. They've just made an administrative decision, the district attorney and the courts there, to not arrest people, but they still refer them to court. They still refer them to the cost docket at the court, which the study found as a result of these fines and fees. Less fines and fees equal less court involvement. So that may be court action related to a new warrant, new court debt being added. As I mentioned, tax intercepts, private collection. So it leads to more involvement with the court system beyond just an arrest or incarceration, which leads to more consequences we've talked about already.
Right. That reminds me of, I guess I'm just going to be plugging Mike's blogs all day today. That reminds me of another quote that Mike had that I think really stuck with our staff at OCJR. And he said in his blog, and then we named the blog after it, an effective criminal legal system doesn't just punish crime, it prevents it. And if we were to truly reform fines and fees, that reduces recidivism. We know that relief from overbearing fines and fees reduces recidivism. So by investing in these measures, we are investing in public safety and we are investing in our community members. The study goes on to say that in the first 3 months after a misdemeanor conviction, respondents whose fines and fees were waived were significantly less likely to be charged with a new offense. And they also had a lower rate of new criminal convictions. And this is in part to what we've been talking about. They have less interaction, less proximity to the system when it's not hanging over their head every single day. And the relief of fees reduces crime for several months. But after a year, they neither contribute to crime nor do they have any specific deterrent effect. I think that's important that sometimes these issues can feel really left or right, but these issues should be and are at the very core of them, bipartisan issues in which we all are saying the same thing. We all want safer communities. We all want effective and fiscally responsible reforms. And this really is, fines and fees is truly a bipartisan, fiscally responsible reform that protects our community.
The crime prevention aspect, I think, is really important. Recidivism, that is an amorphous term. It can mean arrests, it can mean convictions, it can mean anything. And the same is basically true of crime rate, because a crime rate doesn't judge the amount of crime. It obviously judges the amount of crime that has been caught. And the beautiful thing about crime prevention is that you don't have to worry about who's caught, because this is reducing instances of crime, period. Because people are less likely to commit crimes because they don't feel the need to, and they feel psychologically included in their communities, whether that's the state, whether that's the neighborhood or whatever. They're less likely to commit acts of crime. And that is across the board. So we don't have to worry about recidivism. We don't have to worry about crime rates and like what those actually measure, because we're talking about a drop in true instances of criminal activity.
The study results indicate that Ashley just pointed out a minute ago about the deterrent effect. They found that there was no deterrent effect to crime after 12 months due to fines and fees. And there's a whole theory beyond just the, you know, let's not have taxpayers paying for the court system, let's have defendants. There's a whole theory that fines and fees are meant, particularly the fines, are meant to deter crime. And this study says, no, that's not what's happening, at least on the misdemeanor level. It doesn't deter crime for somebody to have a higher court debt load. The data does not show that. And so if we're really truly thinking about ways to deter criminal behavior or to deter what the court would deem as criminal behavior, it's not going to be fines and fees that is going to make that effect. We have to broaden our thinking beyond just a punitive financial result from committing a crime or having a criminal conviction.
Yeah, just to back that up, there's study after study that shows that what really drives deterrence is certainty of punishment rather than the severity. So when people are committing criminal acts, they're usually not thinking, how serious is this crime? But they're thinking, will I get caught? And that is the main thing that drives deterrence. So making more severe fines and fees, as the study shows, is not going to do anything to deter anyone.
I'd like to talk about the study's recommendations towards the end. You know, I come from a policy angle, and so it's really great that they included what can we take from this? How can we do it statewide, every county? What can we do to improve the system? I think one first that they point out, the efforts that the state is making to recover this debt. So like the ones I mentioned before, issuing warrants, doing tax intercepts, sending it to private collection. We don't need to be doing this. The state should not be engaged because it's costing them more money to do that. It's not effective. If we stopped attempting to collect at all costs, the evidence is clear that it would have little adverse effect on court finances because they're not even being collected in the first place. And if we stop doing that and we replace it with budget revenue, as we mentioned before, then we can actually fund our court systems adequately and we don't have to spend time, resources, and money on collecting. So I think that's important. And then second, they point out that the decision, at least in some jurisdictions, to forgive outstanding criminal justice fees en masse is actually a much better way of looking at this. And so the evidence that the study points out is that mass waiver of fines and fees would have no effect on recidivism. It would have no effect on court finances for the reasons that we pointed out. And it would limit the control that the court has on people who are mostly people of color and are in poverty currently. Points out as well that when we look at mass waiving of just fines and fees completely, we just waive it, we get rid of it. I also think it has an effect of repairing that trust and the negative effects that have been really kind of built in now to our court systems in Oklahoma. And then the last solution that they point out is that we can even go further than this. We should abolish this kind of pay for service model on criminal courts. And if we did, the study points out we'd have no effect on crime. It wouldn't go up. It wouldn't necessarily go down, but it would eliminate a large but ineffective bureaucracy that has been created. They refer to it as an ineffective cost recovery bureaucracy. And that's so true. We've created like this whole system to just collect on these debts. They don't do it very successfully, and they do it with so much harm and cost associated with it. And, you know, looking at the last legislative session and looking forward to the legislative session, I know that's still a few months away, but we have allies in the legislature, lawmakers who understand this point, who understand why fines and fees don't make sense for individuals. It doesn't make sense for deterring criminal behavior. It also doesn't make sense to fund our court systems. I think that we do have bright points when it comes to fines and fees moving forward at the legislature, but we need people who maybe listen to this podcast or who care about fines and fees or who have fines and fees themselves and are struggling. Reach out to your local lawmaker, your representative, your senator, whether you're in rural Oklahoma or you think that somebody may not care about this, whether you're in urban Oklahoma and they've said that they don't care about this. This is an issue worth caring about. And I think we need more people calling and saying, court debt, fines and fees is not working in Oklahoma. And it's time to fix it. And there's no better time to fix it than this upcoming legislative session. And we need a coalition of individuals, lawmakers, community members, religious leaders, business leaders, everybody to come together and say that we need a new model in Oklahoma. And the only way to do that is by removing these fines and fees and replacing them with budget revenue.
That's beautifully said. And I just want to add that I think one of the big reasons that there are allies in the legislature and that there are people across the state who realize that this system is not working is that we know what Oklahoma ultimately stands for, both good and bad. It stands for rugged individualism and it stands for personal autonomy. What we're seeing from this system is basically the taking of individualism and the taking of personal autonomy and having that sucked up into a state bureaucracy, as we were just talking about. There's people across the state that realizes this isn't small government. This isn't what they're looking for in their governmental agencies. They want people that respect the individual and their personal autonomy to be able to decide where they should be using their money rather than having it forced upon them to spend their money to fund a state agency.
Thank you for that, Mike. Yeah, thank you both for spending the time on this and making this an issue that's worth talking about.
It always is invigorating, I think, to go back to it and to think of all the people that we could help and how manageable this problem is. There's a lot of criminal legal reform that just feels really daunting a lot of the times, but this is so manageable and so realistic for Oklahoma specifically. We can do this. We can accomplish this. This is something that 100% we can do this. And I think with the elections coming up as well, this is truly a great time to get involved and even just start paying attention to maybe some of these subsections of issues that you didn't maybe know were affecting Oklahoma so gravely or so greatly. And now as you begin to see, I truly think this is a great time to continue to get educated. That's always what I leave our listeners with, is with anything you hear, get educated. So if you did listen to this episode, also go listen to the webinar. Hear it straight from the researchers' mouth, what they were doing, what they were looking for, the landscape and what they saw. It's important to see everything. And while I hope that you find us valuable and trusted resources, see that as well and see for yourself. Continue to get educated, continue to stay involved. And with that, we hope you watch our other episodes and we hope to see you back next week.